contrary to popular wishes, we haven't all forgotten to record this podcast because we were so busy daydreaming about Apple releasing a Mac tablet. This is episode 18 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Andrew Gregory.
And in this podcast, we're talking Moblin 2.0 and GNOME 2.28. Question: is Linux bloated our hot topic? And for our open ballot, are distro release cycles too short? Don't forget, we publish news, features, and more on tuxradar.com, so bookmark it today. You'll also find all our podcast notes there and a wonderful deal for subscribers at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf.
It's time for news. Let's kick off with our roundup of the conferences that went on in the last couple of weeks. Graham, where have you been?
Well, last week, yeah, I was at LinuxCon in Portland. It was the first time I'd ever been to one of these conferences and been able to attend, to actually go to the sessions, like, one after the other and actually learn something, as opposed to trying to organise interviews and running across one side of the conference hall to the other. But anyway, my highlights were actually the keynotes, which are most often the more tedious part of the conference, but there were a couple in particular. There was the round table with Linus Torvalds, along with a load of other kernel hackers. Greg was there, and Ted Cho, who I think we've got an interview with him our OSCON trip.
Super Ted.
And as we posted on Tux Radar, Linus had quite a lot to say.
Some controversial things.
And some controversial things to say.
Discussing later, yeah.
After that...
So Linus was controversial.
In shock.
Well, yeah, honest. I like that. After that, Joe Brockmeyer, which I think he's the community person for OpenSUSE.
He's the community manager, yeah. I saw him a couple of weeks ago.
He did a musical guide to the future of Linux, which was a lot of fun, because he likened Linux distributions to various bands. I've got a list here, which... now, Fedora, he likened to Frank Zappa. It's kind of old school, highly respected, but, you know, something your parents might listen to. OpenSUSE was The Who. I don't know whether he's kind of, maybe that he's got some kind of idolatry thing going on there with OpenSUSE. Debian was The Velvet Underground, which I thought was pretty cool. And my favorite was Ubuntu being Duran Duran. Now, when they showed a picture of Duran Duran on the screen, most of the audience didn't know who they were, which shows something about the age, I think, because the attendees, it's all past them.
Isn't that rather wishful thinking then from Brockmeyer?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. It could have been a semi-insult. I'm not sure how it was taken, how Duran Duran go down in the United States. Jeremy Allison did a recreation of the Golden Penguin Ball, and he was a very, very good Steve Ballmer.
Oh, I've got to see it. It must be on YouTube.
Yeah, it is, with a bald pate and crazy chair throwing antics. That was a lot of fun.
Excellent.
And the whole conference was rounded off by Mark Shuttleworth's keynote, which was the three methods to improve FOSS development.
So how did LinuxCon compare to OSCON then? You were at both, weren't you?
I think it was more like a Greenwich Village to New York. I think that's how it felt. It felt like a smaller community. You bumped into the same people at breakfast every day. You know, you kind of followed people from one session to the next, which I don't find happens so much at OSCON just because of the scale of it. It's two or three or four times bigger.
Also, San Jose wasn't quite what I thought it'd be.
Yeah, that's true.
I was under the impression it was like the center of Silicon Valley, which it is, but it's sort of a center after an earthquake's happened there. Everyone's gone to the extremities, to sort of Mountain View or Cupertino or Palo Alto or whatever.
Yeah.
That's where all the interesting things happen. That's where I sort of expect them to whiz by geeks with lattes and MacBook Pros tapping away business 2.0 ideas.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just dead in San Jose.
We had trouble finding Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I know. Whereas Portland, as you just know, it's a wonderful place.
Yeah, yeah.
If you haven't been there, listeners, you have to go to Portland and go to Powell's Bookstore, because it's just incredible.
Yeah, Portland's lovely. I mean, Portland is a city where they've designed the block sizes to be smaller than regular US block sizes so that you can walk among them.
Oh.
So they're easier to traverse. Wow. You don't get depressed halfway through, you know, when the next corner doesn't ever arrive.
Mike, did you go to America, or have you spent the last week messing about on the continent drinking strong European lager?
Correct. 2 weeks ago, I went to Deutschland, to Nuremberg, for the OpenSUSE conference, which was quite a small get-together, but a lot of the lead developers of SUSE were there. We spoke to Andreas Jaeger, the program manager for the distro, and we put an interview up on Tux Radar, so you see that. And I also spoke to Joe Brockmeyer, Graham, and he told me about the music Linux tie-in as well. He said that he thinks Linux as a whole is a lot like the Ramones.
Oh, yes, yes, he mentioned that, yeah.
So
he wants it to be more like the Beatles. That was his point.
Yes, yes, yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, taking some of the ideas to go mainstream. That interview will be up very shortly, or probably up by the time you hear this. And there was a lot of talk about WebYast at the event as well, which is SUSE's attempt to move the YAST control center into the browser. Think like Webmin, but...
Yeah, I could just imagine what it would look like.
Well,
just as bad. All the best bits of Webmin with all the best bits of YAST.
Well, I kind of mentioned this, and... But Andreas demonstrated a bit, some of it to me. They've only done a few modules. But whereas Webmin is really ugly and plain and austere, WebYast is all Ajax-y and stuff moving around. So it looks quite pretty. Whether it will work.
And who paid for the trip?
I think it was Novell. Yes, thanks to them. Yes.
Is that something the coding from scratch? Because I think one of YAST's problems is that it's generated automatically. They have a command line version of YAST and a GUI version of YAST built from the same code base.
Well, this was another demonstration they had. LibUI, which is the toolkit that they use for YAST, and it's they link YAST against this toolkit, and the toolkit just works it out automatically. If the display environment variable isn't set, it will just switch to an ncursors front end. So it's just one code base.
So the web thing's the same thing? Same one code base?
No. It uses some elements of YAST, some of the modules, some of the back end facilities and the scripts. But it's still in very early development. But they're hoping to get some of it into the next OpenSUSE release 11.2, which is due out in a few months. So
if you were to sum up the OpenSUSE conference in 50 words of German, what would those 50 words be?
Einfach, gute Musik.
Moving on from such nonsense, Moblin 2.0 has finally been released. We've had the beta, and now there's the final version. I have here the list of features, top of which is a new visually rich user experience optimized for netbooks and laptops. Is this just a big bunch of waffle, or is there something to this release?
It is new, and I think they've tried very hard, but I don't like it. I don't find it very usable. The core of Moblin is clutter, which is used for splitting up the panels and for making a kind of a more netbook, low-resolution friendly screen display. And Moblin's got a menu bar at the very top of the screen that scrolls in and out, you know, like auto-hide. So when you move your cursor up to the top, you can choose between various tasks, such as the internet or the launch page, which is a bizarre mix of Twitter feeds, Last.fm music, and web pages. And then a customized version of, I think it's Mozilla, I don't think it's WebKit-based, for the browser, which tended to crash the last time I used it, along with instant messaging, and a kind of a place where you can launch your applications from a big launch menu, but I find that in particular really difficult to use.
So how does it compare with something like Ubuntu Netbook Remix or Olympus Lite?
I think it's nice that they've designed it for netbooks. It's got more of a unified feeling. It's got its own window manager. They've got rid of window borders. Everything is maximized. There's no desktop. So if you close the application, you get back to just seeing the auto hidden menu at the top. There's no desktop metaphor, so applications run in full screen. If you're in more than one, they go in two different spaces, or you add them to a different space. I like that. I think Intel are trying hard to make Moblin something tuned for a netbook, and it works to a degree, but what I don't like is I find it difficult to navigate. I find it difficult to get around, and some of the traditional Linux applications are still clunky in it.
But surely if Moblin is designed to be a strong foundation, then realistically anyone like Ubuntu can come along, use Moblin, change bits they don't like, and re-spin it, keeping the same core so there's compatibility across all devices.
Yeah. I think as a platform, I think you're right, I think it'd be really good. I mean, that's what Mandriva are doing, isn't it? Mandriva are taking Moblin, and of course other distros
will.
But it'll be interesting to see what their take is on it, and they might dramatically improve things.
Well, they haven't got much time, have they, really, before Chrome OS comes out.
No.
It's looking like early next year, maybe late this year if we're lucky to get the first beta release out or whatever. So they've got to try and get something really quite polished before Google comes out with Chrome.
It is quite polished. It makes good use of the accelerated graphics.
About as close as all in, yeah, yeah, all done. Yeah.
Yes. But 2.1's already on the way. Bits of release of that has already come out now, with a couple of minor changes. And I spoke to Alan Dexter from PC Format.
The Alan Dexter.
Because he's the editor of PC Format magazine, and he was flown out to IDF, Intel Development, massive event they have every year. Of course, we weren't invited to Intel, thank you. Anyway, and I asked him what he thought, because he saw Modern 2.1 in action. And the first thing he said was that he was amazed it was real, because at first they just showed him a device running it, a small device, not a netbook, a small device running it. And it looked great. And he thought, well, that's awesome, it's just a screenshot. But it wasn't a screenshot. It started moving around in real time as they touched the screen and stuff. But he said this. He said, it's not often you actually impress the hardware press. Clever. But that's exactly what Intel managed to do with its demonstration of the mobile-centric Moblin 2.1. The concept showed running the as-yet-unreleased OS was very much in the iPhone vein. But thanks to the ability to run several applications at once and change between them easily, it simply came across as much cooler than Apple's tech. Also announced that an app store is all on the way. Although, as ever with an Intel concept, all we need to know now is a manufacturer to turn up and start producing the darn things.
High praise indeed. Cooler than Apple.
Cooler than Apple.
Isn't there a different version of Moblin for smaller devices like mobiles? Is that what he was talking about? Wasn't there an announcement last week?
Yeah, they had both. Yeah, the thing is, they're looking to push into the whole area. I think, obviously, in their interest, they're trying to keep a single code base.
Yeah, but it's a different GUI. It's a different
front end. Yeah, it's a different interface. Yeah,
it sounds better, actually. Yeah. Sounds like that's more...
That's clever again.
Yeah, yeah. There's no doubt that clutter and the whole platform is great. I just don't... It's a personal thing. I don't like the interface.
We are thinking of running a feature on Moblin in the magazine. So, if Moblin excites you, write in and tell us what we should be covering. Should we dedicate 8 whole magazine pages and a big cover of Linux format and more Tux Radar stuff to Moblin? Let us know.
Gnome, Genome, Gnome, Gnome,
Gnusnash Gnome.
2.28 has been released, featuring such delights as a time tracker applet, Gnome Bluetooth, the new Empathy Instant Messenger, and all sorts of other stuff. Has been released. Has anyone had the chance to try it out?
I haven't tried it out yet, but there's one big change in there, which is a kind of behind-the-scenes change.
What an awesome change!
The Epiphany web browser, the standard web browser, has moved from the Gecko rendering engine, as used by Firefox, to WebKit, as used by pretty much everything else now.
Graham, can you add some sort of sound effect of applause behind this podcast? About now. Yeah, so we just clap.
I'm just amazed that Epiphany managed to do it before Conqueror. I mean, what's that all about?
Yeah, they just, plucked it out, pulled Gecko out, slotted WebKit in. They cite performance reasons, and it seems to be the case. I mean, I find Gecko pretty fast now, but a lot of people would say WebKit is the... performance beast.
Surely Conqueror's a political problem there, isn't it? It's KHTML, and they don't want to admit they were wrong and switch to WebKit.
Yeah, maybe. I think that KHTML's too woven into the KD desktop like a cancer that they can't just pull it out.
But it's a big change, and I think this doesn't bode very well for Firefox, I think, or Gecko in general.
Or Gecko.
I don't know how much longer it's going to last.
Well, yeah, I mean, Firefox could switch to... in fact, there is an experimental version of Firefox with WebKit, isn't there?
Is there?
I might have just made that up.
There soon will be a version.
The thing is, with Firefox, I'm worried it's like Conqueror and KHTML. It's like woven into the entire being. Because, the whole Zool thing's rendered, and, the JavaScript settings stuff. It's all very web-based, the whole browser, so it might break so very, very much.
I think, if they were to switch to WebKit, there'd still have to be Gecko and Zool in there just for the back and forward buttons,
Have both, yeah.
One for the About page.
This exchange has got me rather confused, because I sort of drawn a circle around Epiphany switching to WebKit because I thought it was completely irrelevant. Surely no one uses Epiphany anymore.
So you put a circle around it.
Well, they might start using it now.
The distros that ship GNOME tend to just give people Firefox anyway.
Firefox.
But this might change that. Epiphany might go ahead.
I might change. I don't use any Firefox extensions. I don't use a single one of them. So I can switch to Epiphany very easily. But up to now, there's no reason. It's just Firefox with less things. Now it's going to be WebKit. It's going to be faster. It's going to be halfway to Chrome, basically.
Yeah. How many WebKit-based browsers are there on the Linux desktop?
Exactly.
Midori. But that's the only one I know of. So.
Well, that's what I said previously. The Twitter client I talked about a while back had GTK WebKit as one of the components. And I wondered how long it'd be before they started switching, and obviously my predictions come true. But yeah, it's great that it's actually happening. People are moving across to WebKit.
And also, GNOME 2.28 is, they've jettisoned a lot of old APIs and gruft, haven't they? And they moved towards 3.0.
That's great.
which we can all applaud.
The 3.0 is going to be the next release, isn't it?
I don't know if it's going to be the next release, but they're...
In March they're, next
that's
year.
The, that's the hope, yeah.
They're edging towards it, right. Yeah.
My favourite new feature is this. Power Manager now supports laptops with multiple batteries.
Wow.
Which I didn't even know existed. Who has batteries to more than one for their laptop?
There must be some, you know, ridiculously big 17-inch...
21-inch.
21-inch LAN party laptop.
Actually,
yeah.
My old Dell had two bays at the front where you could have an optical drive in or you could replace it with a battery.
Of course. Oh,
right.
That's all the old stuff, isn't it? Replace it with switchable drive
bays.
It's a really weird thing to be working on now.
It's not going to really be a big deal for Mac users now, is it?
Well, speaking of Mac users, the menus have no icons now.
Yes.
By default in GNOME 2.28, which is a very Apple-ish move. Next up, it's time for our Hot Topic section. This time, we're asking the question, is Linux bloated? And we already have our first answer, thanks to Linus Torvalds. As we said previously, Graham went to Portland a few weeks ago, last week. LinuxCon 2009, the first one. And there, Linus Torvalds said... Very clearly, he feels Linux is bloated, and sometimes it makes him sad. It's not the streamlined OS he once hoped it would be. Is Linux bloated?
But is he saying, we should be clear, is he saying it's a fat, slow kernel now that's, you know, unusable? Or is he just saying there's billions of drivers in there, billions of things? Because you can still make a very tiny, modular kernel. You look at Tiny Core Linux. I wouldn't say Linux is bloated. I'd say there's loads of code in there. There's probably lots of crap code and unmaintained code, but you can just compile all that out.
Yeah.
I don't think it's bloated. If the kernel was 40 megabytes every time you compiled it, and it's tremendously slow.
I have managed to compile many a kernel that won't actually boot. It's that big.
Really?
You know when you go through the end cursors dialogue, you're like, oh, that sounds interesting. What's that? Yeah. I don't know. It sounds good. It sounds really awesome. It just doesn't boot in the end because you've put so much crap in there.
Yeah. I haven't compiled a kernel in ages. I used to do it all the time, but
just to get audio to work.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
To get the ZSNES to work.
To get a decent frame rate.
Yeah, the gamepad controller's in.
But while something like Tiny Core Linux can exist, a graphical Linux desktop in 10 megabytes, I can't see how it's bloated. Glibc, meanwhile, at 200 megabytes, that's bloated.
Maybe he's saying, though, that you know MS has managed to go on from Windows 7 to Windows 7 from Windows Vista. And even though it looks quite the same, there is a new version of Windows 7, I believe, or the new Server 1008, or whatever it is, that has a command line only mode.
Yeah.
It was called originally, was it Minlin? Minwin?
Minwin. Yes.
Where it was a super stripped down version of Windows that can go right back to the core now. Obviously, it's not as simplified as Linux could be, perhaps, but maybe he hopes to save Linux one day that we can make even more streamlined, even faster, when needed.
But, well, if that's the case, then, you know, he should open up to pluggable schedulers and other performance
apparently they already exist. Someone said in the comments from last time.
Mike. Yeah, I don't believe that at all.
But he also said, I think he was very reluctant to say that it was bloated, but he said that he couldn't see any other solution to it. So while he admitted that it was bloated and it's massive and, you know, there's so many millions of lines of code in it, he said that he couldn't see any other solution.
Well, that's it. You either have a tiny research operating system for a small niche, or you have a general-purpose desktop OS, and
so
it's going to be
like a mistake. You know, bloated is just one way of looking at it. You know, it's a success is another way of looking at it. The fact that there's so many device drivers, USB 3.
But we, Paul and I found out the other day that there's a file you can create in Windows called LPT1 that you can't actually delete. If you have a file called LPT1, you cannot delete it. Windows starts crying and gets upset because it thinks it's a printer or something like that. And it's just kind of evidence of how much hackery and crap goes on behind the scenes in Windows, probably going back to the DOS.
Just in case readers are interested, we found this out because our friend Scott loaned us his USB hard drive, and we thought we'd hand it back to him with no free disk space. We created this sort of 20 gigs of dev U random. So... that'd be nice for him. He doesn't listen to our podcast, fortunately, hopefully. So
we'll soon find out. Yeah. But, you know, that to me is an example of old code and bloat and crap stuff. Just because there are Linux drivers for Wacom tablets of 20 years ago, that doesn't bother me because you don't have to compile them.
True that. Does Linux feel bloated to you?
Not at all.
Good. Have you ever compiled a kernel before?
I've not compiled a kernel, no, but I have spent a couple of hours going to the... when I reinstalled Windows once, going to the Dell website and downloading driver after driver, and then thinking that I'd got everything, and then finding that something else didn't work. So I don't mind that there are drivers in there that I don't need. I'd rather it were that way around. So, you know, a few extra megs, I really don't care.
I think, correct if I'm wrong, I have to ask an Apple expert for this, but I think the new version of OS X snags drivers from the internet as it needs them for things like printers.
Crikey.
So when you put it in, it won't necessarily recognise it. When you plug it in, it'll go, hey, I can recognise that. Let me get the web and snag it straight away.
A bit like the Ubuntu codec wizard thing.
Yeah, except obviously not just for codecs. It's for everything, pretty much. So I think that's the idea. I think Windows tried it a while back. You know, no drivers are available for this. Do you want to check Windows Update? And the answer was, okay, of course, check Windows Update. There we go. No drivers are found in Windows Update either. But I think Snow Leopard actually has that working. At least I believe. Yeah, expert, correct me. But again, this keeps the initial install image down. And the only install the bits you need. Because presumably it has to, you know, the old days of, what was it called? The hardware scanner that Red Hat used to run every boot.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, everybody.
Everyone's going, oh, no.
Just to see what wasn't working, you know, that's how you could see it.
Yeah. Is it there? No.
Still can't find a joypad.
No, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just in case, because it's a helpful feature. You've plugged in a new hard drive, whatever. Let's find it and use it.
But there'd be various parts of my motherboard that weren't working. You know, you'd see little chipsets coming. No, that USB board isn't supported. They were the days.
Pessimistic.
The happy days.
I was reminded of that recently when I installed Slackware, actually. I'd forgotten.
You installed Slackware?
Yeah, I did.
Cool, what for?
To get away from the bloat of Linux, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, to try out KDE on it.
Is Linux bloated, Graham?
I think my gut feeling is that when you look at all of the kernel options in menu xconfig or whatever it is, there are thousands of them. And maybe it's not bloated, maybe it's just disorganized, because it feels incredibly disorganized to me. If you start looking in the modules directory, everything is all over the place. And of course it's big. I mean, it does have the capability of being incredibly small, runs on mobile phones. So I suppose the real answer is no, it can't be, otherwise it wouldn't run on a mobile phone. But my gut reaction is that yes, it seems big and ungainly and unmanageable. And it must take a lot of effort to manage that. I think, I can't remember what they said, but it's something like for every 5,000 lines or 10,000 lines of code they add to the kernel, they remove 5,000. So it seems like there's a continual recycling of, or reappraising of things.
Yeah, certainly ages ago I spoke to Greg Crowe-Hartman, and he said something crazy like, you know, we had this one event, we rewrote about a quarter to a third of the lines of the kernel.
Yeah.
You know, in this 2 or 3 weeks period, bang, everything changed.
And you get the feeling that it's like this big ivory tower that's just waiting to fall over. I mean, there's not, you know, if there's ever a kernel 3, I don't know, maybe that's what needs to be done. A K-develop and completely go back to basics, but I suppose it works.
So how about we look at it from the bigger picture for a second? Is Linux, as in your average distro, bloated? You know, because if you look at some of the things that the iPhone does very well, it managed to get a full Unix operating system in there, very small, very light, and a simple front end. There's no X going on. It's basically very, very flat system structure. Whereas on Linux, you've got all these different layers, complicated, fighting for control in places. Things are getting slightly better with things like kernel mode setting, whatever. They're getting cleaner. No root X works now, as we talked about a few weeks ago. But is Linux, as a general distro, all these toolkits taking place, fighting for power, just getting bloated and bloated?
Well, there is a lot of historical baggage there, like you say, especially with all the layers of the graphical system, and the audio situation is just horrendous.
It was a running joke at LinuxCon. It was always coming up. Yeah, the joke that Greg will personally come around to your house and fix the audio.
Somebody's got to do it. But yeah, Apple had the advantage that they, you know, very strongly led from the top and can just go and do something like that for a new platform. But Linux is evolving, and yeah, we all get annoyed that certain things still remain from the past, and it could be more streamlined. But you know what you can do with an Ubuntu CD. For 600 megs, the fact you can install an operating system and have a complete office suite and loads of internet tools and even games, and it basically covers 95% of the world's productivity needs. I think that's good.
Is that about 2.5 gigs though, unpacked? It's quite a lot, isn't it?
It is, but what's Windows 7?
Probably about 2.5 gigs unpacked, yeah.
Do you reckon?
Yeah. Because they do the same thing now. It's actually an image, just copies the image across from the DVD into the...
Right. Although, that said, Windows 7 doesn't come... If you actually added the Office suite onto that and various other things.
Right.
But, no, in a world of 500 gig hard drives. I don't think 2.5 gigs is too much. And I'm coming at this from a, you know, a Luddite Amiga viewpoint. So,
well, one thing I found out recently is that GoOO, GoOO,
yeah,
the OOO spin-off that isn't quite a fork apparently, is actually apparently pervasively used on Linux now. But you realize that someone was saying that the Ubuntu version basically takes nearly all its patches from GoOO.
Really?
Well, I couldn't see. I was looking for things like, you know, because GoOO actually adds a lot of features. I think, like, you know, 3D transitions or whatever, they're pretty cool. I couldn't find them in my version. It did have a Sun brand on the Ubuntu one, but apparently it's in there.
Right.
And it's lighter and faster in the GoOO one, just better.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, they've done a lot of performance work in the
GoOO. Yeah, in an effort to just cut down the bloat, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
If we were asking whether openoffice.org is bloated.
What is the Linux desktop? It's Firefox, it's OOO. Both of which are not paragons of efficiency.
Yeah, and X-Windows.
Well, X-Windows got better. Ever since they stopped showing the horrible little boot-up grid thing, have you seen that?
The black and white X-cursor.
Yeah, like, you don't see that anymore, which is quite nice.
But it still does that if you just start X on its own. It's still there.
I kind of like that. It reminds me of the RS6000 machines I used to use at college.
Them's were the days.
Yeah. IBM power machines.
Yeah, yeah.
Ace.
Somebody actually stole one from our computer lab.
Really?
Yeah. By opening the window when they left in the evening, coming back in the dead of night, and climbing up and lifting it out and dropping it down to someone.
Do you still have it?
You particularly like that CPU architecture.
And with such slander, we come to the halfway of our podcast. Still to come, the discovery of the fortnight and our open ballot. Are distro release cycles too short?
Okay, it's time for discovery of the fortnight. Anyone want to start?
I'll start first.
Okay, yours is quick, isn't it?
Mine is quick, and a lot of people may already know this and may think it's a bit crap, but I discovered the --color option for grep. Anybody else know about this?
No. I think we might say LS, they'd laugh at you.
No, well, that's good then. Because, yeah, grep --color actually highlights the thing you're searching for in the text.
That's the way he's saying color.
Color.
It's the American spelling.
Well, maybe color will work as well. I haven't tried it, but grep...
You've got the NGB pack for your language.
Yeah. But it's really, really useful because a lot of the time I'll, you know, grep a big file for something and then look through and then still have to, you know, search.
Yeah.
But this just immediately shows you. So, great.
Does it highlight search terms, is it?
It highlights them in red,
I think I might have seen it.
That's excellent.
Cool.
Great.
Good work.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Paul?
Mine's very slow.
Have you just got one or two?
I've got four.
Oh.
I discovered so many awesome things.
Why don't we rename this section, listen to Paul talk?
Okay, three really quick. Firstly, go to Google and Google search for ASCII art, because it's great. Or you can do recursion, that's great too. That's one. Second one, this is an awesome bit of Japanese. Jaku niku kyo shoku. It means survival of the fittest, but literally the words mean weak meat, strong eat. And that's awesome, that's a great way to explain it. Third one is, I flew on Ryanair recently, the airplane company that you hate because they use Silverlight, and they said, over the intercom thing, recorded voice, not some, just some woman making it up, please don't use mobile phones in this flight, even if they're in flight mode. Which is stupid. That's what flight mode's for. So it's not going to harm this kind of thing. They did it anyway. Finally, my real one. Last week, Joel Spolsky put up a brilliant piece called The Duct Tape Programmer, and it's incredible. You need to read this. It explains why hackers like Jamie Zawinski of Mozilla fame, why they're better than everyone else because they're not obsessed with design patterns, they just get on and code. There's a great quote from that. He said, everybody else is afraid of looking stupid because they just can't keep enough facts in their head at once to make multiple inheritance or templates or COM or multi-threading or any of that stuff work. So they sheepishly go along with whatever faddish programming craziness has come down from the architecture astronauts. And it goes on to say, because otherwise they'd have to admit they just don't feel smart enough to use what would otherwise be a perfectly good programming technique for Spock. My favourite part is this, and this is the key I think. Shipping is a feature. A really important feature. Your product must have it. Now this is very interesting because a few months ago I started working on an iPhone game, and how do I sell the iPhone game? I thought, well, I'd do it the really cheap, nasty way of making downloadable packs of content, right? For extra money. And my awesome friend and advisor suggested that I do this, and I had a go, and it looked really painful. I ended up just dropping the whole thing and forgetting about it, which is stupid because I'd almost finished the code. So recently I thought saw this, I'm going to go ahead and forget that, release it all as one cheap bundle, get out to the world, actually release it because shipping is a feature, and then just go ahead with it. I don't agree with everything he said, and we'll link to it so you can read the article. I do prefer C++, and I definitely do prefer C#. I think multi-threading and templates have their place, but generally he's right. So read the article, it's really, really interesting.
Yeah, just mate, I know this, don't want to turn this into a debate, but I saw this discussed on Slashdot as well, and there were a lot of people saying that's all fine for code you're making yourself, but if somebody else has got to maintain code after you, and you duct taped it all together, then it's just going to cause major problems down the road.
It creates Mozilla.
Exactly, yeah. So
well, I'm a firm believer in coding standards.
Yeah.
And so I think we should all stick to, variable naming, whatever, But design patterns they hurt my head.
Okay.
Cool. Well, I'll go next so that the shock of Andrews isn't too great. Mine is actually that the next version of the GNU debugger is going to have reverse debugging.
Oh, wow.
It's version 7 and it's due out in September.
Okay.
That's imminently.
Next few days.
That's today.
So, yeah, that's today. So hopefully before the end of the year, let's play it safe. But yeah, reverse debugging for anyone who does programming.
Years ago,
that's a kind of a nirvana.
Years ago in Linux Torrent magazine, we covered reverse debugging,
didn't
we?
UndoDB.
Yeah.
And they did a great job.
It worked.
They actually patched GNU DB.
Oh, it was based on GNU DB.
Maybe it's their code. Maybe it's giving up and giving the code away.
Yeah, maybe they're free.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But anyway, it lets you, when you're debugging your code, you step through the program execution. It now means that you can step back. So that if you miss something or you want to go back through a certain function, you can just roll back in time and the GNU debugger will restore memory and registers and everything back to the state it was in the previous instruction.
And if you listen to this thinking that's crazy, it's not going to work. We've seen it work. It is very, very cool. It actually does work. You just go back a line, back a line, back a function, back a function. Yeah. It really works. It's incredible. And it's not too much of a slowdown either.
And when you're debugging, you often realize after the point, after the effect, what has happened and what you need to do. And without having to go back and rerunning and going through all the same conditions, you can just press rewind, which I think is a revolution.
So now we can look forward to a world of bug-free code, can't we?
K Album will finally be bug-free.
That's what you've been waiting for.
Andrew?
I found another Firefox plugin called Invisible Hand. It helps when you're shopping for stuff online, in that it just sits in the top bar of Firefox.
Can you see it?
Yes. Oh, it's not a hand either. Gosh. But it lets you know if the product you're looking at is available anywhere else on the internet for cheaper. And so far all that I can see, the only limiting factor is that it doesn't support that many sites. I mean, at the moment it supports Amazon, Argos, Boots, CD Wow, HMV, Dixons, Maplin, Play.com, PC World. And intriguingly, Asda, but that's the only supermarket. So I don't know how the price comparison works if, it supports Asda and not Tesco's or...
I guess it must be the availability of data.
Yeah.
What these companies watch making their...
Yeah, their prices online. Or
maybe Asda pumps out an RSS or some XML. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Well, it seems to work. It's nice and unobtrusive. And if it can't find anything cheaper, it will pop up and say, I've searched 7 websites... This is the best price. It's great.
It actually says, I've searched.
I don't know if it's... I'm paperphrasing.
But it's a little paperclip.
Yeah. It looks like...
I've searched all these sites for you. I can't find anything else.
And it's named in honour of Adam Smith, who's the first Scotsman to appear on a Bank of England banknote. He's only on £20 notes.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Graham. Good work.
Cheers, Graham.
Great show. Great section. Moving on, it is time for the open ballot, which is back by ever so popular demand. About a week ago, we asked on Tux Radar, are distro release cycles too short? We have Ubuntu at 6 months, we have Fedora at about six months as well, yep, and SUSE tends to be about 9 months. Is this too short? Do we need longer release schedules? Are people not getting enough changes between them? First response was from Spiffy Tech, who said, while the wait between distro releases feels like forever compared to the rate at which the rest of the internet moves, I think the 6-month cycle has been detrimental to the quality of Linux distributions. 6 months is not a lot of time to upgrade all packages, install new technologies, and make sure the distro is robust and reliable. What do you make of that, Graham?
I think I think there's two answers. I think for us, 6 months is too long to get the latest packages, the latest desktop releases and all that in a tidy self-contained distro.
Mm-hmm.
I think for most average users, it's too short. I think if you're in an office environment or something like that, you could stick to the Ubuntu long-term support versions, for example. So I think there's too much emphasis placed on the short, on the 6 month release cycle. I think that's too short for general consumption. But I'm glad it's there personally because it seems like an awfully long time when I'm waiting for the next release.
Well, Emo RRP1 echoes those sentiments as well. He says, I love the fact that a new version of almost all the software on my machine comes out every 6 months. A fresh install also allows me to do some spring and autumn cleaning of all the cruft I tend to collect. But with rolling distro releases, it's very hard to target and say, this is where I'm at. If you're writing documentation, you can say, right, you're running Fedora 10, this is where you'll find Foo, Bar, and Baz. But, you know, with a rolling distro release, you can only say, oh, if you've got it around September of last year, then you might have this library installed.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's kind of what I was saying. There has to be like a punctuation mark, and this is Linux. This is Linux for the next 24 months, or whatever it has to
be. This is the defined base.
Yeah.
With rolling releases, you wouldn't get it September last month. You get it September and then update the new version, update the new version. Everyone would have the latest version, which has the nature of it.
Yeah, which you couldn't write for. Because, you know, it takes six months or whatever to write.
Yeah, I know. If you're constantly moving things around the menus, then fair enough. But things don't change that much. It does irritate me when, you know, as I'm with I think it was one of the Ubuntu's recently, they had 2.4. When 3.0 had just come out and could have been in there, but chose not to do it because it wasn't quite stable, yada, yada, yada. And people have to wait for the next version. I think it was jointed to come out with more features.
Yeah.
And that annoyed folks. And it's even worse when it's a driver. You know, you can't have that driver. You must wait for another version of Linux to come out in 6 months. That's depressing.
No, but it should just make drivers easier to install.
They should, yeah. That's a whole other issue.
It is a whole other issue, but that's the solution, perhaps. Remixer96 says, the answer to this question is no, because updates are what brings more awesome to my machine. Honestly, I wouldn't care if there was even a daily dose of awesome. So it sounds like Gentoo's just for him.
Sounds like you should read more Tux Radar.
It sounds like he does.
Your daily dose of awesome.
Yeah. Kaito says, rolling. I'd like to see a rolling release with a focus on keeping the system stable, not necessarily bleeding edge.
Having, is that an oxymoron?
I think so.
Stable rolling release?
Yeah.
Yeah, but as you were saying, you know, if you've silently got OpenOffice.org 3 in the background once it was ready or considered stable, that would be quite nice.
It would be very nice, yeah.
He says, having the system altered so sometimes drastically every 6 months, with changes to locations of files and programs, it can make life hard for even the most avid Linux fan. Jimbo Scotland talks about Ubuntu specifically. He makes an interesting point. He says, I think as Ubuntu begins to mature, we will see Canonical put more emphasis on its LTS releases as the de facto release most people should opt for, hiding away the regular 6 month releases from average users. Upgrading every 2 years rather than every 6 months is a much more sane proposition for the average computer user who just wants something that works.
I think it's a great idea. I
quite agree. That'd be great, particularly with the PPAs.
Yes.
Yeah.
If they can sort that out and make that very
nice
easy.
Nice GUI to PPAs.
Yeah.
So you could subscribe to things that you're
Well, you say that. Kermit Koala makes it easier to use PPAs.
Ah.
Not much easier. You just basically paste the line in, it's PPA colon whatever, da da da.
Yeah.
But it makes it easy to use PPAs. And the thing is, for example, the PPAs, that's the personal package archive, so readers haven't tried them before, that you download software from any software through it for Ubuntu. The 00 one, the OpenOffice.org one, is done by the Ubuntu 00 maintainer.
Oh, right.
And so you can get 3.1 for your current jaunty, but let's put the PPA in.
Yeah.
He supports it. He wrote it. You know, it works. It's the same thing he's doing for Karmic. So it's great.
I can see what Anonymous SE6 has done here. He or she says, this is really obvious, no? It should be 9 months like humans. Ubuntu says Linux for human beings, so why have they chosen 6 months? So should it be based around the human gestation period?
I was thinking that's quite nice, 9 months' time, because in one 12-month period, you get two releases, and in another 12-month period, you get one. So you actually do very well out of it, and there's more development time.
Why not choose like the gestation period of a koala, or a lynx, or a heron?
Or an elephant.
For every release.
Yeah. What is the gestation period of a koala? And that's why they can't choose them, because no one knows!
Wikipedia it somebody quickly.
But rolling releases, right? They only work... Yeah, if you've got one of those broadband things. If you don't, then they don't work.
That's fine. I have no problem with that. Well, to be fair, I've noticed recently, every day I start Ubuntu, it goes, there's some updates available for Ubuntu. Yeah. Come on, it can't be that bad, guys. I know I've got, you know, a lot of software installed, but there are so many updates nowadays. Yeah. And the way, I think it's getting more like Apple or something perhaps, because often it'll say something like, you know, we have fixed tiny, tiny bug in tiny, tiny library, and it wants to update KDE 4 base, da 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 da, and there's loads of packages required, because for the same reason.
If that annoys you so much, surely there's a way to change it so it only annoys you, so and only notifies you of updates once every week or once every month.
Yeah, but I'm not getting the updates, I know, I'm not getting the security. The knowledge of that, my Ubuntu's safe.
His box will be pwnzored very quickly.
The thing is, I turn it on, I turn it off every single day. I might just change it. Please just go ahead and do it without asking me. But do it I turn off without asking. Just do it. Doesn't Windows do that?
Something like, it does by default. It just says, I'll do it in the background. You know?
When you turn off, it'll say something like, turn off after installing all my updates.
Yeah, yeah, but then you wake up in the morning, you go up to your computer and it's still on.
That's another problem again.
I think part of the problem with rolling releases, like Andrew says, if you don't have the internet, then you're stuck at a certain point, which can be a quality control problem. When you've got a set release, there's a certain amount of effort that goes into polishing it and making sure it all works. But with rolling releases, it's very easy for developers to say, well, let's just pump it out, you know, because we can fix it the next day if a big bug is found.
Yeah, but it'd be good if someone like Canonical made Ubuntu into a rolling release distribution and still had the LTS version.
Oh, interesting. So the normal, the stuff that we geeks use on a day-to-day basis, we're always getting the latest stuff, and then they make a kind of snapshot and say...
We surely can't base the future of our distros around dial-up users.
No, but what about businesses where they need a really, really stable platform?
But then they'll get the 24-month tested version.
The LTS version,
yeah. But because they don't want software to be updated. They need it to be patched, but they don't want new versions coming out all the time.
They want the 7-year support of Red Hat and Linux, basically, don't they?
You say dial-up users almost with a note of contempt, but absolutely, you know, there's huge swathes of places that aren't in Western Europe and North America that don't have broadband.
Yeah, and they can use a 24-month release cycle. For the majority of computer users around me have broadband. In fact, sorry, all of them have broadband, as far as I can tell. You know, across the US, across Europe, broadband is basically everywhere.
Isn't one of the stated aims of Ubuntu to widen computer access for people?
Absolutely, yeah. LTS support, go ahead and get it out there every 2 years, let everyone have it, let it not be rolling release, fixed, polished, wonderful, that's fine. But for the rest of us, we want new software as it comes out. Having to do a fresh reinstall just encourages breakage. People are so used to the idea now that, when you update, you know, move your .kde folder somewhere because it might overwrite it with new settings and break it. That shouldn't have to happen. It should be just, you know, continuously just replacing itself and updating itself. The thing is, so many people now say, 6 months have gone by, I'm going to have to reformat and install Ubuntu because I don't dare update. It's that bad. Ubuntu is pretty good at it. Ubuntu is actually one of the better ones. Fedora is worse, and OpenSUSE is pretty bad too. I mean, other people like Graham end up with such a fragged PC by the end of 6 months, they have to reinstall.
Yeah. I think rolling updates is the answer, actually. I think that'd be nice. That gives Linux a real advantage because there's lots, you know, it's free. You don't have to pay for it.
Yeah, definitely. And isn't that one of the nice things about iPhone OS? That you know in 3 months you'll go, hey, here's some new features. You know, you can now do this or this or this and use that for free because you get that. It's great.
Yeah.
That's a nice feeling. You have to install new software. It just does it for you.
Yeah, yeah. Having to reinstall every 6 months is pretty crude, isn't it, actually?
Yeah, think about it.
Yeah.
So the question is, are they too short? Graham, yes or no?
I think so, yes.
If they're too short.
Do you want them longer?
For general consumption, yes.
All right.
Yeah. I think there's no problem at all. I think they can go even shorter.
I want rolling releases for the geeks and longer for everyone else.
I think they're grand as they are.
Excellent.
Brilliant.
But you use Hardy Heron, don't you?
Yeah.
Right.
Motion passed.
And Hardy Heron works fine as long as no one comes over my shoulder and tries to fix things and ends up accidentally breaking them.
Right. Yeah, Mike.
You didn't need that bit of your screen anyway, did you?
And with such Ubuntu rage, we come to the end of our podcast. Don't forget all the notes from this podcast.
Knock, knock.
Website.
Knock, knock.
Who's there, Mike?
One.
One who?
One more thing.
Oh, you sure it's not one extra thing?
It's one supplementary thing, this podcast. You call yourself Linux geeks. So, no? I'm gonna do a test here. Two things. Who can remember, what's the date, what was the date when Linus Torvalds posted the first announcement of Linux?
1991.
Andrew's got the year. Anybody want to?
January?
Nope.
March?
Paul? Any guess?
not January then.
This was a seminal announcement. This.
I'm winning.
October.
Close enough. It was August.
Yeah, but the thing is, the problem is, I still think in the old Roman calendar before January, February.
When October was the 10th month. I mean the 8th month. So
exactly.
Double fail.
So I was basically right in spirit.
Yeah. So can anybody remember the gist of the announcement? Is it always flowing?
I'm creating a free operating system. It won't be big and fancy like GNU. Something.
And Andrew's got the start of it.
I'll just leave this here. That's all he said.
I'll just leave it. I'm doing a free operating system, just a hobby. Won't be big and professional like GNU. It's been brewing since April and starting to get ready. And that's when he asked for feedback on it. And, well, here we are today.
It's now fat and bloated.
Now it's fat and bloated. Never mind, eh? Sorry, Linus.
And the one last thing is?
Something else, I forget, you know.
Wasn't that good anyway, really, was it? And with that, we come to the real end of our podcast. Don't forget, all the notes for this podcast are on the website. And you can tune in next week after you've subscribed at tinyurl.com/podcastlxf or, thanks to our mess up last week, tinyurl.com/lxfpodcast. Either one works. You can subscribe for a wonderful deal, just $99 for American readers and cheap for everyone else too. Check it out, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Cheers.